Welcome to CRE Radio with Howard Klein, radio for and about the commercial real estate professional. Our focus is exploring issues facing landlords and tenants, property and asset managers, investors, brokers, lenders, and everyone in the industry. Our style is conversation over coffee with highly experienced commercial real estate professionals. Over 35 years, Howard's legal and commercial real estate practice has centered on broker, leasing, and property management issues. CRE Radio is presented with the intent of engaging, educating, and entertaining our audience. Access our archive shows, upcoming schedule, and engaging articles at creradio.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for CRE Radio. And now, here's Howard Klein.
Welcome to CRE Radio. Today's topic is new franchise legislation, point counterpoint. Our featured guests are Eric Wolf, Esquire, and Robert Pervin, Esquire. Our call-in number is 619-393-6492. That's 619-393-6492. If you want to ask a question or leave a comment, press 1 to talk when you call in. You can also give us comments on Twitter at CRE Radio and leave comments on the webpage. That's http://, or just www.creradio.com/franchise_legislation. Now, that's a mouthful. Now, I understand that now I'm sitting here because I lost weight. I'm freezing, and it's about 60 degrees outside. So if you're listening to the show in Washington, D.C., where Eric is from, I believe, you're probably already hating me because I understand today is Frigid Friday, somewhere in the mid parts, northern mid parts of the United States. It's in the minus 10s and minus 20s with wind chill factor. So why don't we start out with the show and let's start an introduction. Eric, if you don't mind, would you please introduce yourself and give your 30-second elevator speech?
Sure. Well, first of all, Howard, thank you for having me on the show. And actually, I am in sunny and cold San Diego today rather than warm Washington, D.C., which is an irony of the weather patterns. I've been in the business of franchise law for over 30 years. We represent primarily franchisors. And we also represent the International Franchise Association, which is an industry association of franchisors and franchisees.
And let me also introduce Robert Pervin. Robert has been on the show before. Robert, why don't you give us your 30-second elevator pitch?
Well, I'm also talking to you from Southern California, where I'm headquartered. Talk to my rookie friend here, Eric, who's only practiced a mere 30 years. I have another 10 years on him. In terms of my practicing of law, I started the practice of law January of 1973, which was coincidentally the year and maybe the day that the very first franchise protective legislation, disclosure legislation, went into effect in California. So I've been around as long as there have been franchise laws. My primary course of life, I guess, has been as the chairman and founder of a franchisee association called the American Association of Franchisees and Dealers, which has itself been around for about coming up in 22 years now, as the largest and oldest generic association representing franchise owners. The AFD is an organization that has largely been dedicated to marketplace solutions, and we have not focused until recently on legislative efforts to regulate the franchise industry or to protect franchisee rights, which is the subject of today's call. So I'll leave it there.
Well, great. Now, that means that both of you have been on opposite sides of the negotiating table on a number of occasions, which is why I have both of you here. Now, in preparation for the show, I didn't mention this to you, but you have the unique ability on our show to literally reach across the telephone and grab each other by the throat. And I expect the two of you to do that.
That's going to be a bit out of character for Eric and I, because we have been reaching across the table for many years, and both on in forums like this and on for respective clients, and we have found common ground more often than we have failed to do so.
Yeah, I would say we are respectful adversaries.
But I'm
happy to reach across the phone and grab my dear friend Robert by the neck, if that works.
Just in case you have the fleeting thought, I do have the control to prevent you from reaching across the phone and grabbing my neck. So
there you go.
It's my ball game, and you play by my rules, so you don't play at all. There you go.
Yes,
so
sir.
So why don't we start out as a baseline here, because really the idea of this show came from an article written by Eric where he talked about new state legislative efforts. So I thought it would be a good idea for us to discuss the federal legislative efforts and what those efforts were. Eric, why don't you start out?
Well, I think, and as Robert mentioned, he was around way back when, before I was born in 1973, with the new the first franchise law in California. I think just by way of background, franchising, at least business format franchising, has been around since the 1950s and 1960s. And there were abuses that occurred, and California was the first state that enacted what was essentially a disclosure law. And other states followed suit. The Federal Trade Commission also was looking into franchising. And the FTC moves very slowly, but they eventually got around to promulgating what's called the FTC rule on franchising by 1981. And since then, there really has not been, since that period of the 1970s and 1980s, has not been a whole lot of legislative activity in terms of enacting new franchise laws. At the same time, a number of states also enacted franchise relationship laws, or they tacked that on to their franchise disclosure laws. And they're typically fairly benign from a franchisor perspective, because they simply say you can't terminate a franchisee without good cause. If you're not going to renew, you have to give them notice in advance, et cetera, all of which one can live with. In the 1990s, we saw an interesting development, and that is a very strong sentiment by franchisee rights advocates that the regime was not enough and that federal legislation was called for. And this was originally taken on by a New York representative, LaFalce, in the early 1990s, and he introduced a series of bills in Congress that really didn't get very far. Then by the late 90s, I think it was 1998, Robert, Coble introduced the Fair Franchise.
No, it was 93 and 94, actually. He picked up right on the heels of LaFalce.
The heels of LaFalce?
Yes.
Well, I thought, well, in any event, during the 90s, I thought it was 1998. But so there was this Small Business Franchise Act that was introduced, and it had all kinds of elements relating to the franchise relationship that that the bill sought to legislatively regulate. And the franchisor part of the industry was extremely concerned by all of this, and made a concerted effort to lobby against the passage of that legislation.
Eric, we're going to take a break at this moment. When we come back, I'd like to see if Bob could fill in and discuss some of those new or those efforts in the 90s and why there was such a push to try to enact legislation relating to the relationship. So we'll be right back, and we're currently with our guests Robert Pervin and Eric Wolf.
The Institute of Real Estate Management believes good management matters and that well-managed properties pay big dividends. IREM delivers the power of knowledge and recognizes the importance of sharing it. IREM serves real estate professionals who manage all property types. They're dedicated to delivering cutting-edge networking and educational opportunities for every stage of your career. How can IREM help you? To count the ways, log on to IREM Orange County. That's IREMOC.org. Learn more today. If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today. For questions, feedback, or topics you'd like to hear about, you can reach us on our website. Click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @CREradio, via email to questions@creradio.com, or call in during the live show at 619-393-6492 and press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back to CRE Radio. I'd like to take a moment to welcome a new sponsor to the CRE Radio family. That's Building Block CRE. Building Block CRE manages your commercial real estate practice, your clients, deals, properties, prospects, teams, and records. It's a full service CRE program specifically for commercial real estate agents. It's built from the ground up by brokers for brokers, so you know that it takes care of what you need, taken care of simply, quickly, and I might add, at a great price. We'll be talking more about Building Block CRE in later shows, but to get more information, go to www.blockcre.com. That's www.blockcre.com. So, before the break, we were talking with Eric and Bob about some of the federal legislative efforts in the 90s to get involved in and regulate the relationship between the franchisees and franchisors. Excuse me. Bob, why don't you take it from here?
Well, just to I agree pretty much with what Eric had, the summary that Eric was giving, but to give you the other sort of the other side of the of that scenario, and I was very much involved at that time. I actually was one of the draftspersons for the LaFalce legislation that Eric mentioned. The problem that had developed or had been observed by people who represented franchise owners was that on the heels of the success of McDonald's primarily, but other major franchisors, and on the heels of the disclosure laws, which gave the illusion at least of some kind of protection, government protection of franchisee interests, the industry exploded, and franchising became very popular. The International Franchise Association was at that time about 30 years old and was a very strong voice in favor of franchising and supportive of franchising. And we had what I deemed to be a runaway marketplace. At that time, I should say that I was a development guy. Most of my law practice was, as Eric's, was in developing franchise concepts and developing franchise agreements. But what we discovered is there was a lot of bad product that was out there, and there was an evolution of the franchise model, which was represented as business ownership, a safe and secure path to business ownership, but the actual franchise agreement wasn't delivering most of those incidents of ownership. And some of the things that were being disclosed properly were a lack of market protection. A franchisor, which historically gave you a defined market territory, suddenly began giving you no market territory, but they disclosed it So McDonald's, you had a protected territory all the way out to the curb of your street, and McDonald's could open another restaurant next door. There was also opportunism with respect to suppliers. In fact, I consider it the biggest concern even today, is that a franchisor's ability to control who a franchisee buys from gives the franchisor a huge ability to go make vendor deals that can line that franchisor's pocket, and to the detriment of franchisees. We can talk about some specific examples, if you like, of chains where franchisees do very poorly because of the franchisor's management of its supply chain. So these were some of the areas, and there was also the issue of encroachment, or what McDonald's is called impact, where franchisors put franchise locations too close together and impact the profitability of the individual store units.
These federal efforts failed, though. Why did they fail?
Well, I'm not sure. I think the reason that they failed, and I'm not sure that Eric would agree with you that they did fail, but I think that the problem in franchising, in fact, I wrote a book on this subject, was that unlike the regulation of securities or other types of governmental regulation efforts in which disclosure was the centerpiece, in the securities industry, you had to meet minimum standards if you wanted to issue securities or if you wanted to broker securities. A broker or an issuer could only sell a security to a suitable investor and had to meet certain minimum financial standards before he was allowed to the public markets. But the franchise disclosure law, which was promoted as similar to securities laws, had no minimum standards. So the LaFosse legislation that Eric referenced was intended to impose primarily a level of minimum standards that a franchisor needed to meet before they could engage in franchising. There was also efforts to identify certain practices as unlawful or as unfair business practices. And that's where most of the difficulties, I think, developed. But there was great opposition on the franchisor side of the ball, and there was no organized effort at that time, and that's right around the time the AFD began, and there was another organization that was really got behind the legislative effort, organized, and they were trying to bring together franchisee groups. But the mismatch,
Bob,
of economics was huge.
Can I stop you there a second? Now, Eric, I just can't believe that you're going to let Bob do all the talking.
You're correct. I would say that Bob's characterization of what led up to this legislative effort is absolutely correct. And I think it was a shot across the bow for franchisors to take heed of what they were doing. And I think as part of that, the International Franchise Association then reached across the table to franchisees and also invited them to become members of the International Franchise Association so that they would not just represent franchisors, but franchising, if you will. The one thing I would diverge a little bit from with Bob is that there wasn't really an organized effort by franchisee advocates to support this bill. I think this other franchisee organization, which was called the AFA, and I believe a woman by the name of Susan Kezios was behind that. And it's interesting because Bob's efforts all along have been marketplace-driven solutions, in other words, negotiations between franchisors and franchisees rather than legislatively imposed solutions. And so this other organization took the lead in trying to seek a legislative solution. And indeed, I was asked to speak at one of their conferences back at that time. And there were, gosh, there must have been close to 800 people there. And I was the only franchisor speaker at that conference. So you can well imagine that I got a warm reception. But there was a great deal of interest, I think, by franchisee rights advocates to go down this legislative path. Bob can perhaps speak better to the issue of, well, why did the franchisee side didn't succeed? I think from the franchisor side, it was, I think, a very persuasive demonstration that you really can't. Franchising is a method of doing business. It's not just McDonald's. It's not just fast food. It's real estate companies. It's hotels. It's all kinds of service industries, and these are different businesses. And suggesting that a solution for one industry also is the same equally good solution for another industry is just misguided. And I think the franchisor rights advocates were pretty persuasive in telling that story and getting the regulators to focus more on improving the quality of disclosure. And Bob mentioned a couple of issues, which I think are absolutely right. The question of supplier relationships, et cetera.
Well, let's pause briefly for a few words from our beloved sponsors. So stay with us, and when we come back, we'll continue on with the conversation, Eric. Thank you.
What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail, and it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com, create your own account, market your empty spaces, or view available locations for your business, all on one convenient site, PopUpInsider.com.
Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to tacticsmagazine.com. Today would be good. tacticsmagazine.com.
If you have questions or a point you'd like to make during the live show, call in at 619-393-6492 and press 1 to be placed in queue to speak live with Howard and his guests. That's 619 area, 393-6492. During the live show, then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back to CRE Radio today. Thanks for being with us. Where we had just left off with Eric Wolf, what were you talking about, Eric?
I think the franchisor part of the community, I think, took these legislative efforts very seriously. They not only lobbied against them, but at the same time reached out to the franchisee side of the community to work better with them. And I think Robert's organization is one that also headed in that direction, and I think we're was welcomed.
Eric, you can go ahead and you guys don't have to wait for me to ask questions. You could just come in if you have any comments.
Well, we, unfortunately, we're in pretty much violent agreement on many of the points that we've each been raising. Our organization, the American Association of Franchisees and Dealers, did believe and still believes that the franchising community needs to act as a community and needs to find common ground. And that's always been our preferred path to move things forward. When things get stuck and we're unable to make progress, folks get frustrated, franchisees get frustrated because they're on the shorter end of the stick, I'm afraid. And that's when you see efforts for legislation to start up again. I think Eric's correct that we did see a period of time following the failed efforts for legislation in the 1990s where franchisee associations began to get formed. There was more negotiation in the development of franchise businesses and franchise models. Franchisors did recognize that some of the – I'm going to kind of retrench for a second, because some of the things that franchisees want are things that I believe franchisors would immediately concede or would move towards because they make sense. The example I gave earlier of having a protected territory. But in negotiation, as it's always said, if you're not going to get what you failed to ask for, and franchisees did not have a vehicle in which negotiations could really take place. I say that because it would be inopportune, as Eric, and I'm sure Eric would agree with this, for a franchisor to sit down and negotiate uniquely every single franchise agreement. That franchisor would be developing an incredibly impossible situation to manage an association that has, you know, if you have 1,000 units, if you had 1,000 different versions of your franchise agreement. So it was really a situation that called out not for a legislative result, but for a negotiated result. And for a period of time, that seemed to be working until very recently, in which there seems to be a new, and thus the impetus for this show, a new push for legislation, which I think we can explain why that's coming about and where it's going.
Well, why don't we get right into it? But before we do that, I feel like I really failed here because the two of you seem awfully reasonable. And I'm ready to nominate both of you to go to Congress because you seem to know how to get things. You seem to know how to get things done. Where did I find the two of you?
Well, I think the reality is that Bob and I have been on the other side of a number of situations and have been able to work together constructively in finding solutions. So we probably are amongst the more reasonable within the community. That being said, that does not suggest that we are in sync on all these issues. And although I have a great deal of respect for Bob's efforts to form the AAFD, it's not something that I think most franchise companies would voluntarily embrace. They would prefer to run their own systems their own way. I think for the most part, franchisors act responsibly in managing their systems, and they look at the interests of both franchisors and franchisees as they make their decisions about how the systems evolve and change. The economy has been obviously in a recession, and with bumps starting to come back, that has had a major impact on small businesses, including franchised units. And franchisors have had to adapt to the changing economic circumstances. Technology is changing things tremendously, et cetera. So we are in a period of great change in the business world, including franchising. And I think that is what's fueling the legislative efforts now. I think, and from my perspective, from a franchisor perspective, these legislative efforts are, again, at this time, a shot across the bow to take heed. All is not well. We need to really focus on our franchise systems. Are we doing the right thing? Are we making sure that franchisees' interests are properly reflected in the decisions that we make, et cetera?
Well, we'll be right back with more from Bob Pervin and Eric Wolf here on CRE Radio.
Attention commercial real estate brokers and professionals. Have you ever struggled to find the true ownership behind a commercial property? What about finding the phone number, email, and name of the actual decision maker? ProspectNow.com tracks this information on more than 10 million commercial and multifamily properties nationwide. Howard's listeners are invited to a 3-day free trial. Simply go to ProspectNow.com and enter the promotion code Howard.
That's ProspectNow.com.
If you need anything with your company logo on it, you need Monogram Magic. T-shirts, ball caps, polo shirts, anything. Monogram Magic does it beautifully, does it right, and does it right on time. For over 20 years, Monogram Magic has produced corporate apparel your people will be proud to wear. large orders, or small, it's all about attention to detail. See for yourself. Here's the website, logostolife.com. That's L-O-G-O-S, the number 2, then L-I-F-E.com, logostolife.com. If you have questions or a point you'd like to make during the live show, call in at 619-393-6492 and press 1 to be placed in queue to speak live with Howard and his guests. That's 619 area, 393-6492. During the live show, then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back to CRE Radio. I'd like to mention this show is brought to you by Building Blocks CRE. It's available from anywhere commercial real estate solution to manage your practice, your clients, your deals, properties, prospects, teams, and records. Go to www.blockcre.com for more information. So, gentlemen, why don't we now start discussing what the new legislative push is, the state efforts, and why don't we start with, I guess since Eric wrote the article, why don't we start with Eric and then maybe we'll switch to Bob, where we might talk about California.
Okay. The efforts have all come about in this last year. The four states that have introduced legislation include California, but then also Pennsylvania, Maine, and Massachusetts. What's of interest here is that California is the only state of these four that already regulates franchising. So we've got some new players now appearing in terms of seeking to regulate franchising. All of these proposals have very different features, but the common theme in them is protection against arbitrary termination, failure to renew, acting in good faith. The encroachment issue that Bob mentioned also appears in a number of these, and issues of a right to be compensated on expiration of a franchise if the franchisor imposes a non-compete. Those are some of the elements of the Pennsylvania Act. They're also legislative proposal. There also appears to be some statutory mandate that franchisors must change to competitive circumstances in the market, and I don't know what in the world that means. Maine also has a number of similar features, but it's got these anomalies of that a franchisee is entitled to a right of uniform standard of conduct. I don't think anyone really knows what that means. It gets pretty granular about franchisees have a right not to be open between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., set their own prices, renewals without increasing fees, and so on. So you can see there in any number of aspects of the franchise relationship that is sought to be regulated here in various ways in these states. California, and I will now defer to my friend Robert, also has two bills that are pending. They're perhaps a little more benign than those proposed in the other states, with one major exception. And I will take Bob on with respect to that exception.
Go to it,
Bob. I'm not sure I know what the exception is.
It relates. It's your favorite subject. It's franchisee associations and recognition and negotiation. Oh. Yeah.
So, yes, in California, our organization is part of a consortium of associations that has been promoting some legislative participation. And again, we come to this discussion not where we would like to be. We would like there to be greater collective bargaining, greater influence of franchisee associations working out differences in franchise systems on a system-by-system basis. That's where I've always felt was the way franchising should develop. I personally believe that the greatest influence of the efforts to promote legislation is in coaxing the various parties to get back to the conference table. And I'd rather the legislative threat be just that, a threat of legislation that motivates folks to do what they ought to have done, invoking the golden rule in their relationships. But the various legislative efforts are just a resurgence, in my mind, of the same frustrations that led us to the similar efforts in the early 1990s, where franchisees feel that they're not getting the respect that they're due, that they feel that there is opportunism or even abuse that's happening not in all franchise systems. I don't think the indictment, just like we make it illegal to commit murder, it's not because everybody in society goes around murdering people, but there are fringe elements in the society that are criminals that need to be, and the laws need to be impactful of those folks. And so I agree with Eric that I don't think that all franchisors are bad folks. And I think that most franchisors are trying to do right by their systems and their brands and have a concern for their franchisees. But there are opportunistic players out there, and there maybe are players that either become desperate because of their own situations that lines get crossed. In California, a year ago, there was a bill that came out of nowhere that was issued by an assemblyman who was on his way to Congress, and in his parting shot in the assembly, I'm trying to remember, Jared is his last name, introduced an omnibus bill that sort of was everything but the kitchen sink, addressing all the various abuses of franchising. And the bill was championed in particular by a coalition of franchisee associations called the Coalition of Franchise Associations. And that group has now spawned similar legislation in the other states that Eric, and I think that there are a couple of other states that have also have laws pending. They just haven't been taken up, that are really omnibus bills that identify a whole lot of abuses or what are considered to be abusive practices, and we've talked about all of them at various stages of this discussion. And that legislation is, I think, unfortunate because it would tie the hands of franchisors in many ways from doing things that they're supposed to be doing, which is to create competitive atmospheres for their brand and to build brand awareness. I would rather see legislation that says we respect the right of franchisors to do certain things, but there are also times when behavior is abusive. And the legislation that the AFD supports and is sponsored in California is a piece of legislation that does basically two things. Number one is it does recognize or repeats the recognition in California of the right of franchisees to organize and participate in trade associations, which have negotiating capabilities. And secondly, we would impose a duty, an affirmative duty of good faith and fair dealing in the franchise relationship. And in particular, the way this legislation was drafted, with respect to the sale of a franchise, the renewal of a franchise, the transfer of a franchise, and the termination of a franchise. And we feel that by imposing good faith between the parties is an appropriate thing to do, and will eliminate abusive activities.
Yeah, I'd like to get back to the conversation of good faith, because we know as lawyers that good faith is implied in every single contract. So when we come back after this break, maybe we can enter into that part of the conversation and why we need legislation to impose this argument of good faith. We'll be right back.
Do more business with your biggest clients. Techniques Marketing has perfected exciting new ways to increase your revenue with all your key accounts, way beyond trial and error. And we've done it with some of the biggest companies in America. Look, if you're happy with your numbers, great. If not, let's talk. Visit TechniquesMarketing.com. TECH, that's the tech, NIQUES. There you've got the Neeks. TechniquesMarketing.com. The Institute of Real Estate Management believes good management matters and that well-managed properties pay big dividends. IREM delivers the power of knowledge and recognizes the importance of sharing it. IREM serves real estate professionals who manage all property types. They're dedicated to delivering cutting-edge networking and educational opportunities for every stage of your career. How can IREM help you? To count the ways, log on to IREM Orange County. That's IREMOC.org. Learn more today. For questions, feedback, or topics you'd like to hear about, you can reach us on our website. Click the comment button on any show page at CREradio.com, on Twitter, send a reply to @CREradio, via email to questions@CREradio.com, or call in during the live show at 619-393-6492 and press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back. Building Block CRE is simple, easy to use, and can be used by a single broker or a team, and includes great reports and brochures. Go to www.blockscre.com for more information. All right, Bob, so now's your chance. Why do we need to get additional legislation that imposes an obligation of fair dealing and good faith on franchisors? That's, to me, already there. Or maybe explain how it's not there.
Well, the problem is with the implied warranty of good faith is that it does not create any affirmative duties. It deals with duties that already exist, and imposes limitations in a way an operator can act that it can be used in a defensive format. But if you write into your franchise agreement very strict provisions that give you the right to do opportunistic things, then the implied warranty of good faith has failed in numerous instances when franchisees have tried to use that as a protective device. By the way, good faith has been probably the most successful tool that franchisees have used over the last 20 years. Having failed to try to create a fiduciary obligation, they've been able to at least use the duty of good faith with some success. But the idea that was introduced by Senator Hannabeth Jackson, a state senator in California, was we ought to have an affirmative duty between the parties that's applicable to the parties that they will work with legal teeth and private right of action behind it, that they will work in good faith to move a brand forward for the mutual benefit of all parties. So that's the primary deficit of the duty of good faith. It's worse than that, though, because we're seeing creeping into franchise agreements across the country provisions which eviscerate the duty of good faith that even would be implied. So I've seen contracts that basically say that if there is a duty of good faith, it doesn't count in this agreement. It doesn't prevent us from exercising the discretions that we get to do. And we basically don't have to act in good faith with respect to any of the things that we've reserved to our discretion. And when you put that clause in, my worry is that that judges will say, good faith is canceled by this clause.
Well, this is where Robert and I diverge. First of all, I don't think you can contractually waive the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. I think the clauses that Robert is referring to, which seek to define how this concept of good faith and fair dealing is to be interpreted, in hindsight, by a trier of fact, whether it's a judge or an arbitrator, is an effort to avoid Monday morning quarterbacking on a franchisor having to make decisions and exercising discretion and deciding that marketing program A is perhaps preferable to marketing program B. And it turns out that marketing program A, in hindsight, didn't work all that well. And the notion of then creating legal liability for what's essentially a business judgment is what drives the franchisor community to try to limit the application of this common law concept of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Now, as it relates to the statutory aspect of it that Robert mentioned, the real difficulty with that is, what are you trying to achieve beyond what the common law already gives you? And what they're trying to achieve is to be able to have a statutory provision that trumps contractual provisions. And so if the contract says franchisor can do A and it does A, then this gives – and franchisees don't like it. This then gives a franchisee a legal right to challenge it based on good faith, despite the fact that the contract says franchisor may do A. And this all goes back to the franchisor argument, which is, look, full and fair disclosure is really the answer to all of this. If you as a prospective franchisee have concerns about opportunistic behavior by a franchisor, acting arbitrarily, et cetera, if you have full and fair disclosure at the front end, getting into the relationship, you have access to the existing franchisees. You have access to whatever litigation has occurred in the franchise system, et cetera. And you decide to go forward despite the fact that what you see are warning signs, then you really don't have anything further to complain about. You went in with eyes wide open.
If only it were so that franchise agreements were understood by franchisees and disclosure documents were read by franchisees, or even the franchisees went to attorneys and franchisees, having read them, said, there's no way I would enter into that agreement. I'm suddenly getting flashes of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and Pinocchio as Pinocchio being introduced to Funland.
But Robert, as the FTC said, I mean, and it's in boldface language on the cover page. Read this document. Go see a lawyer. I mean, does the government have to be that paternalistic?
I don't think it's a question of paternalism, and where it works in the securities law, where we have similar prospectuses, which are truly not read by the people that they're meant to protect, probably not even read by the brokers that offer those securities to their customers. There is, at least in the securities industry, a framework of law that requires the industry to be paternalistic, to make sure that you've got a suitable investment and a suitable investor. We don't have that in franchising. And the problem is, in franchising, it's worse than in the securities industry and the other side, because most franchisees bet the farm. And you're right, they should have read, they should have gone to the attorney, and having gone to the attorney, they should not have bought the franchise. I was on a conference call with a group of people yesterday that had bought automotive services franchises, and they've asked me to review their franchise agreement for purposes of hopefully negotiating it. And when I read the franchise agreement and I got on the phone with them yesterday, I said, what were you guys thinking when you signed this agreement, which doesn't give you a right to any territorial protection? It doesn't give you the right to set your prices. It doesn't even give you the right to buy your oil from in a competitive framework. You have to buy all your oil where the franchisor tells you, and you really have your hands locked. But they hadn't, any of them, read or understood or believed they had an ability to negotiate their agreements. So whereas my preference, where Eric and I agree, is that this shouldn't be done at the legislative area. This should be done at the conference table, where we form agreements that make sense for both of us. But that's not what's happening in franchising, and unless we can wake the industry up to better behavior, then that's when legislators jump in and start saying, if you're not going to take care of it, we'll take care of it.
I think one of the things that franchisors have done to address some of the concerns that Robert raises is to create avenues of and channels of communications, particularly franchise companies as they grow and they get larger and larger, that direct link that the founder may have to the first few franchisees. They tend to be people who
maybe friends or in the community, and there's a relationship that those folks have, and they can tap right into that if they've got concerns. But as these systems grow, that kind of personal touch tends to diminish. And so what franchisors then tend to do, not all of them do it, but I think most responsible ones do it, they set up franchisee advisory councils. And so the kind of issues that that Robert raises that he characterizes as being opportunistic, which tends to be situations where the marketplace, competitive circumstances are mandating change. You've got to change. Something has to happen because the business is suffering. And you take, for example, in the restaurant industry, unit upgrades, refreshing it, remodeling, perhaps changing the menu items, etc. All of those things, this is not opportunistic behavior. This is reacting to marketplace changes. And the real question is, are you seeking franchisee input as you're making those decisions, or are you not?
Eric, why don't we take a short break? And I don't want you to lose this conversation. As soon as we're done with our break here and hear from those people who pay our bills around here, gentlemen, we will go back and talk about some of this.
If you need anything with your company logo on it, you need Monogram Magic. T-shirts, ball caps, polo shirts, anything. Monogram Magic does it beautifully, does it right, and does it right on time. For over 20 years, Monogram Magic has produced corporate apparel your people will be proud to wear. Large orders or small, it's all about attention to detail. See for yourself. Here's the website, logostolife.com. That's L-O-G-O-S, the number 2, then L-I-F-E.com, logostolife.com.
Attention commercial real estate brokers and professionals. Have you ever struggled to find the true ownership behind a commercial property? What about finding the phone number, email, and name of the actual decision maker? ProspectNow.com tracks this information on more than 10 million commercial and multifamily properties nationwide. Howard's listeners are invited to a 3-day free trial. Simply go to ProspectNow.com and enter the promotion code Howard.
That's ProspectNow.com.
Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to tacticsmagazine.com. Today would be good. tacticsmagazine.com.
For questions, feedback, or to suggest a topic, here's how to reach us. On our website, click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @creradio or via email to questions@creradio.com.
Welcome back to CRE Radio with our guests, Robert Pervin and Eric Wolf. Okay. All right. I'm going to throw in my two cents at this point in time. Bob, I've been hearing you complain about a situation that, as a lawyer, for 40 years for you, 38 years for me, and 30 years for Eric, we deal with this our entire careers. A client walks in and they say, "We've got a problem." And you look at it and go, "What were you thinking when you signed this? Why didn't you hire me before you even got there?" But this is a business-to-business situation. California is well known for protecting consumers, but not businesses to business. If you're in a business, you have to do your own due diligence. You have to be treated like a big boy, and people have to know. And I think that this is one of the reasons why your organization is such a great idea. It should be out there doing and communicating to all these franchisees saying, look, you need to be in a better bargaining position, and you do need to see franchise lawyers. But why should this be legislation?
Consumerism is where franchising falls. Matthew Bender, I don't know if they're still around, but a major publisher of legal treatises, as you both know, published a treatise on consumer protection, and they had a section in the huge treatise where they dealt with all kinds of, you know, landlord-tenant, and they dealt with products liability and all and airline safety and all the different areas of lending and all the areas of consumerism. And they get to the section on franchising, and they say that franchising is the only area where consumer protection is not protected by a framework of laws. And it's still the case, because the courts and the legislatures have pretty much agreed with you, Howard, that these are supposed to be business-to-business conversations, and we don't try to have broad-based consumer protection laws. But it's time to wake up and realize that franchising, there are hundreds of thousands of people that buy franchise businesses, and they believe that they're protected by a framework of regulation, which you and I and Eric knows are only disclosure laws. So there really isn't any baseline protection in the franchise industry. Now, I happen to agree with both of you gentlemen that this ought to be resolved in a negotiable environment. The problem is that the big associations that are out there, trademark-specific associations, which I had thought had taken care of their own business, the McDonald's of the world, the Burger Kings of the world, the Meineke's of the world, I could go on and on talking about different KFC, Subway, all have major trade associations that have been at negotiations. But oddly, it's these various associations that are pressing for this legislative protection, because they don't think they're getting the kind of respect that they need to get at the bargaining table. The AFD, which is an organization dedicated to marketplace solutions, I've had to really move in the direction of legislation or to lose relevance with our constituents. So the problems that are out there are so real that if we don't embrace them, franchisors and franchisee groups, and say we've got to come up with ways that we can treat each other more respectfully and in better faith than we are now doing, we're going to be facing laws. And I think that at a personal level, I agree with you. I would like to see the marketplace being taken care of these things, but they're not right now.
Well, I'm not in favor of anybody being abused, period. But I'm surprised that I'm sounding so conservative from this perspective, but it just seems to me that legislating that people need to be nice and respectful is just not the way to go about it. Personally, me, I would go out and sing your praises, Bob, and say anybody who does not hire Bob Pervin or be a member of his organization and you want to be a franchisee, you're out of your mind to try to handle it on your own. Don't be stupid. But how far do we go protecting people from being stupid?
I would disagree with Bob in terms of the characterization of the franchisee associations and advisory councils that these large franchise companies have. They tend to be very active and at times can be adversarial to their franchisors, which is not necessarily constructive, but it happens. And, for example, in the Burger King system, they were some years ago making some changes and recommending price discounting, et cetera. The Franchisee Association jumped all over that with lawsuits and so forth. I don't think that they are paper tigers. I think that these are associations that have real clout by the fact that they represent a large number, if not a majority, of a franchisor's customers, which are its franchisees. And when they speak in unison with one voice on particular issues, franchisors listen. So I do think that for the most part, this kind of dialogue, if you will, within franchise systems works. Not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying that there aren't situations where it doesn't work. And I agree with you, Howard, and Robert, that when these things break down or when they don't exist, I think an organization like Robert's is a good organization where franchisees can then go. To me, when I get a letter from Robert saying I represent such and such franchisee association of your client, that's a shot across my bow, realizing it has gotten that bad within that system that they've gone to Bob to try to have their views heard. And so I do think Bob's organization plays a very effective role in all of this, but I would disagree with him in suggesting that a lot of these trademark-specific associations are not effective. I think for the most part they are.
Well, I didn't suggest that they weren't effective. In fact, in my mind, I thought many of them had been. The point that I was making is that these associations that we might agree have had positive effects or effects on their systems are the ones that are pushing for legislation. They're feeling frustrated. The problem comes back to the fact that in franchising and in the typical mode of franchising, a franchisor goes to an attorney like Eric and says, I need to create a franchise system and my interest needs to be protected. And Eric correctly writes a franchise agreement that protects the interest of that franchisor, not interested in protecting the interest of the guy that will buy the franchise, but protecting his client's interests, with the expectation that when that franchise gets offered, the person who's going to buy it's going to turn around and say, well, my interests need to be worked out and let's have a conversation. As a practical matter, a franchisor can't have that conversation with 1,000 different owners. They need a uniform agreement. So unless there is a collective bargaining effort, there isn't going to be negotiation in that agreement. And in the absence of collective bargaining, the only way to protect that class of people is through a legislative minimum that says that at least the parties have to deal in good faith, or the more aggressive manner, which most of these statutes would impose, identifying specific practices and saying that these practices are unlawful as unfair business practices. And there's one, Howard, I don't know how much time we have, but
we can stretch on a bit because this is the best part of the whole conversation.
Well, in particular, I'd like to use one particular area that I find most egregious, but also most confounding. And that has to do with the ability of a franchisor to control his suppliers and to dictate to the franchisees both what they buy and who they buy from.
Eric, Bob is starting to excite you again.
So
he is.
Let me just finish this thought, because I was going to immediately say that the ability of a franchisor to dictate what a franchisee buys and who he buys from is one of the most important elements in a franchise. It's what makes franchising so magical, that to be able to effect group purchasing, to be able to protect your brand so that the brand appears and tastes and feels and the services are the same throughout the system, is essential to, you know, you talk about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. When you tell a franchisor he cannot dictate those things, you are destroying what makes franchising so great. That's not the problem. The problem is when a franchisor exercises that ability in an abusive way. Some would say an opportunistic way. I consider it to be an abusive way. And if a franchisor takes that great power, which is essential to the success of his brand, to a height of lining his own pocket at the expense of the franchisee, a properly reserved position in the franchise agreement exercised in a way that comes out abusive is what these laws are trying to prevent.
I have two comments to Robert's eloquent statement about supplier relations. One is, I think that the notion of abuse in the supplier relationship is quite different when you have a franchisor that also has significant number of franchisor-owned units. You take a company like Panera Bread, which is about 50% company-owned, 50% franchised. I don't know what franchisee could reasonably claim that whatever its supplier relations are somehow unfair to those that are operating at a unit level, because the franchisor is in the trenches just as much as the franchisee. The other observation I would have is there have been systems where franchisees have gotten very upset about franchisor practices with respect to suppliers and rebates and things of that nature. And through the efforts of associations like Bob's have persuaded the franchisor to spin them off into cooperatives, independent entities that are then controlled by the franchisees. I was amazed a couple of years ago this had happened to Burger King. I was in Miami. I picked up the newspaper, and I read on the front page that the franchisee directors of this co-op, or a couple of them, were being indicted for taking kickbacks. So the notion that somehow franchisee control of this solves these problems, I don't think is really the answer. I think the answer is to have corporate policies on ethical conduct.
Well, I, as I said earlier on, and I have to repeat this because in all areas of criminal law, we deal with fringes. We have a law in the books that says it's illegal to murder, but that's not directed at the whole population because most of us aren't murderers. And the fact of the matter is that Eric and I would agree that many franchisors, I'm not sure I agree that most, but many franchisors act in an appropriate manner and take their system to heart and will not be impacted by this legislation because they already act in good faith. But there are franchisors that act in abusive ways, and not all of these franchisors have allowed franchisee organizations to exist. We still have a big problem, which is the other part of this law, where franchisors retaliate against franchisees when they try to form organizations, which, by the way, is opposite not only the AFD's code of ethics, but the International Franchise Association's code of ethics, the organization that predominantly represents franchisors. But it occurs. So the problem is, how do we take something that has become a systemic issue and create a curb for it? Now, I will tell you that to me, the most important value of legislation is its threat, because the threat of legislation in the 1990s and hopefully again is what drove franchisors to the table to say, let's work this out without having laws invade our province. But when things get out of hand, there's one particular example I'd like to throw out to you gentlemen. Eric mentions Panera Bread, but the more interesting comparison that I've been looking at very recently because of some reports on SBA, there's been a lot of reports about SBA failure rates of SBA loans. And the interesting comparison is that Subway has among the lowest incidents of SBA failures of any major franchise system, maybe the lowest. The worst instance of failure rate is Quiznos, its arch competitor. Both brands, I think, are proud brands. Both brands have excellent products, and they're very equivalent in their pricing and their structure. And so you begin to wonder, well, why are Quiznos franchisees fail at a highest rate where Subway doesn't? And what you find is when you only peel back one layer of the onion skin, is that in Subway, the Subway system has created one of these purchasing cooperatives so that franchisees are engaged in the control of the supply system. Subway still has the right to select suppliers, but has created a culture in which there is a cooperative, where Quiznos doesn't. Quiznos controls its supply chain and dictates all sources of supply and it heavily profits from rebates, making the Subway business model an excellent profit margin versus the Quiznos business model, which is a very unattractive profit margin. I would suggest that the Quiznos folks have tried and failed to organize. They've been retaliated against. That's where the law would be impactful. It's not even necessary for Subway, although the Subway Association is pushing for these laws. That's the other thing that you need to be aware of.
Wouldn't that be a perfect reason why someone wouldn't become a Quiznos franchisee if all of that information was disclosed?
But it is disclosed, and they do buy. And so I guess – and they buy thousands. Quiznos has sold thousands of franchises. And Quiznos, I'm certain, fully discloses every aspect, appropriate aspect of their franchise network. So the disclosure laws have not only not solved that problem, they've exacerbated it because they give the implication that all is well and good without it being factually true.
Robert, how paternalistic can you get?
Well, I don't think you need to get very paternalistic to solve the problem. I think that if you impose a duty of – and by the way, Eric, you know that I come to this conversation more in agreement with you than in disagreement. I would much rather see – and I've spent the last 25 years of effort trying to build franchisee associations. The other piece that the AFD has done – not with great success, I'm afraid, but we've actually created an accreditation for franchisors whose practices meet our fair franchising standards. The AFD has developed a body of fair franchising standards over the course of many years through a process of negotiation with franchisors and franchise attorneys participating in the dialogue. And when we find companies that meet our standards, we ask they have to have a franchisee association. The association has to nominate them, and then we have to actually survey all the franchisees. It's a very expensive process. And the companies that have earned our accreditation have pretty much gone to the top of the charts. So a company that Eric has represented for many years, Meineke, actually effected a turnaround in part because of the effort of becoming accredited. But other major brands have earned AFD accreditation or have come close to it. But the industry has not moved in the direction of rushing to be accredited, which is what our private method of regulation was intended. We wanted the marketplace to do its job, and it had been my vision and dream that one day you wouldn't dream about going to the market without AFD accreditation, and at that point in time we would have solved in the marketplace all of these issues.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to wrap up the show right now. So I'd like to wrap it up in this way. If there was one thing that a listener should take away from the show, Eric, what would that be?
It would be that we are in a challenging economic environment where most businesses have to work twice as hard to get half of what they were earning before. It has put a lot of pressure on marginal operators. And it's put a lot of pressure on successful operations as well. I think what comes out of all of this is companies need to better manage their franchise systems, or we will see this kind of legislation.
Bob, what would be the one thing that a listener should take away from your perspective?
I think the main thing that I would hope a listener, especially a listener who's thinking about investing in a franchise, is to practice safe franchising and to do that by saying no to unfair franchise opportunities that are out there. I think if prospective investors began to say no to propositions that were not in their best interests or protecting their interests, then the marketplace would reach forward and would offer deals that would meet their interests. The unfortunate part of our conclusion is when the marketplace fails, that's when legislators start to dip in. And I agree with Eric. I would rather have it be done in the marketplace than at the state legislature level.
Well, I've got one or two takeaways. First, I think generally we're all in agreement that, that it probably would be better for the marketplace to kind of regulate itself. And from that perspective, I like the idea of, you know, the AFD accreditation. I think that that's a great idea. I think that maybe there should be reporting agencies to report failure rates just generally, because I think that will affect. If everybody knew that Quiznos had the highest failure rate, that maybe that would force changes by Quiznos to operate in a different way. And then finally, I think that, and I agree with you, Bob, that franchisees really need an advocate. They really need to practice good franchising and know what you're doing before you go in. I'm not sure that legislation is the way to do that. I would go out of my way to promote AFD and Bob and everyone else who is out there to protect the franchisees. Obviously, there's more that needs to be done. From the landlord's perspective, I deal with failed franchises all the time. And it's kind of pitiful that, you know, I'm evicting these people and the franchisees, for the most part, are left, you know, holding the bag. And so I'm in favor of both of you. Isn't that politically correct of me?
That's very nice.
Yes, I know. Bob, I hope you come back to the show. I'm afraid that I may have sounded like I was ganging up on you with Eric, and I certainly didn't mean to do that. I'm actually much more impressed with you now than I was even before. I certainly would recommend any franchisee to seek you out. And along those lines, how can our listeners contact you, Bob?
Well, we're at AFD.org is our website, and on our website there are many opportunities to contact us directly. Our 800 number, if I can give that over the phone,
absolutely.
Is 1-800-733-9858. We're taking messages all the time, and I appreciate to the extent that this becomes an advertisement for the AFD. Eric, thank you for recommending me to the show.
You're welcome.
And Eric, how can our listeners contact you?
Well, I'm with DLA Piper in Washington, D.C. My email address is Eric, E-R-I-K, dot Wolf, spelled W-U-U-L-F-F, at DLAPiper.com.
And for anybody who wants to leave comments with regard to this show, you can go to our website at www.creradio.com/franchise_legislation. And gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us on the show. This was a marvelous discussion. Absolutely great discussion. Bob, I'm going to go out to Palm Desert, and I'm going to let you throw a punch in my shoulder. You know, maybe I deserved it. Don't hit me in the face. My wife will get upset at you. And as always, thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Please listen again next time to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Every live and recorded broadcast is accessible on your desktop, tablet, or smartphone at creradio.com or in iTunes, just search for CRE Radio. Here's how to reach us with your questions, feedback, and show topics you'd like to hear about. On our website, click the comment button on any show page at creradio.com. On Twitter, send a reply to @CRE Radio, via email to questions@creradio.com. Or call in during the live show at 619-393-6492 and press 1 to be placed in queue. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented on an informational basis only, with the intent of engaging, educating, and entertaining our listeners. Howard and his guests' conversations specifically do not offer legal advice. If you need legal advice, please consult your own attorney. Portions of the show may have been pre-recorded. Unauthorized editing or copying of the show without the express written consent of CRE Radio is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
And that's a wrap.